Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture titled The Day After the Day After Tomorrow, An Update on Abrupt Climate Changes by Dr. Richard B. Alley, Professor of Geology at the Pennsylvania State University.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In recent years, there has been something of a global revival of interest in the music, the history, the mythology of the Celts. However, it's really difficult to know exactly who the Celts were, what they were really like, what they really thought about, what they truly believed, and certainly what cultural legacy this European civilization left behind after essentially being swallowed up by the Roman Empire. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Philip Freeman. He is an associate professor of classics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And he has written about the Celts in a new book that's entitled The Philosopher and the Druids, A Journey Among the Ancient Celts. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And in the introduction to the book, he explains that we know about the ancient Celts through different kinds of evidence, what has been written about them by Greeks and Romans, through archaeology, and through the study of the early Celtic languages. However, he writes, by far, our best source for the true story of the Celts comes from the pen of a single man who is scarcely remembered today, a Greek philosopher of the first century BC named Posidonius. When he was a young man, he set out on a journey to the still unconquered Celtic lands of Western Europe. He wrote a book about it, a book titled History. A book that now has been largely lost, but one which influenced a lot of writers that came after Posidonius. And in this book, The Philosopher and the Druids, Freeman talks about what we know about Posidonius and his trip, and also what we know now about the Celts and their culture and their way of life. And that is what we'll talk about here this morning in this part of the show. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening are welcome to call. All we ask of people is just that they try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along, but anybody can call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free. 800-222-WILO. Those are the numbers. And again, at any point here, if someone has a question, you can call. Professor Freeman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I think now today when you talk about things Celtic, probably people are most likely to think of Ireland. And maybe a point to start with would be to talk a little bit about how widespread in Europe Celtic people and Celtic culture was, and we're not just talking about Ireland, we're talking about a big piece of Western Europe.
Oh, absolutely. The Celts were all over what we consider Europe today. They were on the shores of Ireland, they were in Britain, they were all over France, or in the ancient term Gaul. They were in Spain, they were in northern Italy, they went down into Greece, and there were even a bunch of Celts right in the middle of Turkey. Called the Galatians.
This, in part, these people are thought of as a cohesive people, in part because of language, but also, I guess, in part because of culture. Is there something in particular that, in a general sense, you can talk about that all these different people, that ties them all together?
Yeah, well, it's a good point. They were very different, and they probably looked different from each other, but they did all speak a common language, and that's really central to the Celtic identity. Also, they had at least elements of a common religion. There's a number of gods who show up all over the place in the Celtic world. They had a very similar style of warfare. They had druids. The druids do not show up everywhere that the ancient Celts were, but they show up in Ireland, Britain, France. And so there were a lot of different elements that held the Celts together, even though they were individual tribes.
Mm-hmm. The word apparently comes from the Greeks, going back quite a long time. The Greek word is Keltoi.
Yes.
The first written reference of this goes back to the 500s BC. So certainly by the time Posidonius comes along, the Greeks knew that these people were there. What would your average Greek, or, well, your educated Greek, at the time of Posidonius been able to tell you about who these people were and how they lived?
Well, a number of different authors had written about the Celts by the time of Posidonius, and the Celts had actually come down into Greece and come down into Rome in the 300s and the 200s B.C. So what the Greeks and the Romans knew about the Celts was mostly that they were tremendous warriors and very scary and very good at what they did. So your average classical person would know that they performed human sacrifice. They would know that they were very tall, that they wore bright-colored clothing, and they would know something about their culture. They would know something about their art. They were the Celts were very respected for their technology. Their weapons, their ironworking, their art was beautiful and in some ways surpassed what the Greeks and the Romans could do.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that the Greeks and possibly the Romans would have there's a word I'm thinking of that they might have used to describe these people that we still use to talk about someone who we feel is uncultured. and the word is barbarian. And interestingly enough, I guess, as far as the Greeks were concerned, that word could be applied to anybody who wasn't Greek. It
Absolutely.
Was a word that meant anybody who's not us.
Absolutely. The Greeks considered the Romans barbarians.
I'm sure that they did.
But what it was, the word comes from a sound that the Greeks, you know, when the Greeks heard somebody speaking a language that wasn't Greek, it sounded like nonsense to them. Mm. So the Greeks made fun of them by saying bar, 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 bar. So that's where we get the term barbarian from.
Mm-hmm. And though I guess the point is that if you take a look at the people that we're talking about, the Celts, and take a look at their material culture, at their religious beliefs, at their philosophy, at their way of living life, and then make a comparison, say, between the Romans or the Greeks, it would not be correct to say that somehow these people were unsophisticated. It would be rather unfair to apply to them a term like barbarian.
I think it would, really, because the Celts were very good, as I said, like in technology and art, but they were also wonderful poets. They studied the stars, so they had a fairly good working knowledge of astronomy. They did not have the literature and the philosophy. They didn't have a Plato or a Virgil or somebody who wrote down their extensive knowledge, but they had that knowledge, and they had it in oral form. So I think it would be very unfair to call the Celts barbarians.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this man, Posidonius. He was someone who worked in different areas. He was an astronomer. He was a geographer. He was a philosopher. He was of the Stoic school.
Yes.
Maybe we could start there, just because there I think people will have this association with that word. Today, if we say someone is Stoic, that means that they're that don't display a lot of emotion, I guess. Was that, in fact, a quality of the original Stoics with capital S?
Well, it was. I mean, it was much more complicated than that, and Stoicism was a very broad and wide movement, so you had lots of different varieties. But one of the basic ideas of the Stoics was not letting the circumstances of life affect you, whether those circumstances were really happy or really sad. It was, I guess, the ability to roll with the punches was one of the ideas. And the belief in an orderly universe. They believed in a sort of God, but it wasn't like a Judeo-Christian God. It was more of an ordering force in the universe. So they were very interested in how the humanity and how different cultures ordered themselves. And I think this is one reason that Posidonius went to the West and studied the Celts, is he wanted to find out what these people were like before the Romans got to them, because I'm sure he knew that the Romans would eventually conquer them. So he was kind of like Lewis and Clark setting out to the West before anybody could spoil this civilization.
Well, would it be fair to say, I'm not sure at what point the word anthropology was coined, but would it be fair to say that's what he was doing?
I think so. He was very interested in anthropology. And like you said, he was an astronomer and a physical scientist, and he was a man for all seasons. He certainly was. He gave the ancient world its best description of tides Nobody really understood tithes very well until Posidonius came along and hooked them to the phases of the moon. So he was truly a man who could do just about anything.
He traveled greatly in this region. He was not born in Greece. He was born in Syria.
Born in Syria. Syria was part of the greater Greek world at that point. After Alexander the Great, a Greek civilization had spread to Syria and Egypt and even all the way to India. So even though he was not born in Greece, he was very much a Greek.
Mm. And so he traveled, he certainly traveled in Greece, he traveled in Italy, in North Africa, into what is today France, into Spain. And apparently it was in Spain where he spent a lot of time watching the tides and I guess just spent a lot of time watching it go back and forth, thinking about what was going on and made these observations about what exactly was going on.
He did. The Greeks were very good at theoretical science. They loved to sit in the library in Alexandria or Athens and think about how things might work. But Posidonius was unique in that he actually went out and observed. So he went to Spain. He went to what is now modern Cadiz in southern Spain on the Atlantic Ocean, and he rented a villa there. And he went and down, and he checked the tides several times a day, and he watched, and he observed, and he measured, which was really, it sounds normal to us, but it was very surprising for a Greek scientist to do that.
Mm-hmm. Is there, because there's, it's sort of hard to know a lot about him because the record has been so lost and is now so fragmentary. And so we certainly know that he was interested in all of these areas and he wrote in them. But I'm not sure that anything that he wrote has survived intact. Is that right?
That's right. It's really just fragments, quotations by other authors. When he wrote a number of different works, but this book that had the Celts in it was called His History. And it was a very popular book in the ancient world. And everybody who was anybody read it. And so we get a lot of quotations from people, various Roman scholars especially quote this. So we have these paragraphs, really, or even shorter than that, sometimes just sentences, that are taken directly from Posidonius's book. And we have, there are several hundred of these paragraphs. So part of the challenge and the excitement of studying Posidonius is to piece all of these together and to try to reconstruct as best we can this puzzle of his book. It was lost by the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. It was gone. But we still have these fragments that are left.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that's enough to really be able to say something with certainty about the man himself?
Well, it's enough to give us bits and pieces. It's certainly not everything we would like at all about the ancient world, but and about Posidonius. But that's really how a lot of our knowledge of the ancient world is. It's fragmentary. You take somebody like Cicero or Sophocles, and we've lost a lot of the things that they wrote. We only have a very small percentage of classical literature surviving. So and with Posidonius, that's even more true. But I think it is enough to get some sort of an insight into this man and what he did.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Philip Freeman. He is associate professor and Quali professor of classics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. He's a former visiting scholar at Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of St. Patrick of Ireland, which is a book about St. Patrick, obviously, and also a new book here that's entitled The Philosopher and the Druids, A Journey Among the Ancient Celts, and it is published by Simon & Schuster and takes its inspiration, sort of its jumping-off point, indeed, from this trip made by this Greek philosopher, mathematician, astronomer, geographer, historian named Posidonius, who traveled in what was at that time Gaul, is now France, and wrote about the culture of the Celts in a book that he called His History, a book that is lost but clearly influenced later writers. And Philip Freeman is using that as a kind of a framework to write a little book about Celts and their culture. So if you're interested, that might make a good introduction to the subject. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He, apparently, he would have, or I don't know if you're sure that he did, or you figure that he would have probably started his journey into Gaul at what is now Marseille, was then the city of Massalia on the Mediterranean. That, I guess, would have been, at that time, a very important commercial port?
Oh, absolutely. We know that he must have been in Massalia. And Massalia was a Greek town. It was founded about 600 B.C. by colonists from Greece. And so it had been there for centuries by the time Posidonius got there. It was the entryway into Gaul. It was at the mouth of the Rhone River, which flows up into the heart of Gaul. So any trade that took place between the classical world and Gaul passed through Massalia. And we know from lots of later authors that they say it was a trilingual city, that you could wander the streets of Massalia and hear Latin and Greek and Celtic being spoken all the time.
What was this under the, essentially under the control of Rome at the time?
Well, the Massalians were allies of Rome at the time. They were an independent city because they had long been friendly to Rome, but they didn't try to assert their independence too much. They knew what was good for them. They knew who was running things. So they were basically a Roman city with certain rights of their own.
Now, at this time in Gaul, there was not one people here, there was not one group, there was not one political system. What exactly would, how many different peoples just in this area here that's now France would you have, and what sort of relationship would there have been between different peoples, I don't know if administrative unit is exactly the right way to, the right kind of terminology, but different peoples living in different groups sort of governing or running their own affairs?
Sure. I think tribes is probably the best word to use. There were dozens of dozens and dozens of tribes scattered throughout Gaul. Some of them were quite large. Some of them were huge, over 100,000 people probably in them. Some of them were smaller. They were all ruled over by kings, and sometimes the kings had a lot of power for themselves. Sometimes they shared it, more often they shared it among different nobles and different warriors. And there were relations between all the different tribes. Usually they were fighting each other, but they were often trading and talking to each other as well. And the Druids were a pan-Gaulish organization so that they could move freely between different tribes. And that was a great advantage to the different rulers of Gaul.
Mm-hmm. You tell a story in the introduction to the book about how a meeting between some emissaries from the Celts and Alexander the Great. Now, whether we know this is actually a true story, this is somewhat apocryphal, I'm not sure, but that the story is that he was Alexander was sitting there outside his tent on the banks of the Danube, so you write, and some Celtish warriors come wandering in. And they said that they were interested in establishing a relationship with Alexander and the Macedonians, and so Alexander invites them in, and they sit around and they're having some drinks, and getting to the point where people will talk the way they do, and Alexander asked them, "What do you fear most?" And they said nothing. See, he said, "We honor the friendship of a man like you more than anything in the world, but we are afraid of nothing at all." And then the man makes a joke. He said, "Except that the sky might fall down on our heads." So Alexander and his men thought that the Celts were a little full of themselves. But as you said before, they certainly did have this reputation as being very fierce warriors. What did they think of the Greeks and the Romans, those people that they came in contact with that were part of these larger, potentially very threatening powers to them?
Well, it was sort of a love-hate relationship, really. The Celts admired the Greeks and the Romans for their material goods and their wine, especially. They loved wine, and wine was the most popular trade item that went through Massalia and went everywhere else into the Celtic world from the classical world. But they looked down on the Greeks and the Romans a bit as, well, the Greeks and Romans were smaller, for one thing. The Celts maybe averaged almost 6 feet tall. Your average Greek or Roman would have been several inches shorter than that. So they admired them in a way and admired their culture, and yet looked down on them as a bit of kind of weaklings, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you could imagine that might be the dynamic, that on the one hand the Greeks and Romans would look on the Celts as barbarians, as being rough and tough and not very cultured and not very sophisticated, and you could imagine that the Celts would look at the Greeks and Romans and think that these guys were just a little on the soft side.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, from what do we know about Posidonius from where he went from? We're assuming that he started his journey in Marseille, in Massalia. What do we know about where he went from there?
Well, we don't know very much for certain at all, but we can sort of figure out where he probably went. And what he probably did was he went up the Rhone River, and the area around Massalia was controlled by the Romans, so that was very civilized. But once you got up past modern Lyon, you were in the wild west of the Celtic world, the place that the Romans didn't live. So what he probably did, and this is conjecture, but he probably went up to one of the very large Celtic towns that were in the heart of Gaul, and they towns like Alesia, which Caesar would later destroy. And he probably made a base there and got to know some of the local merchants, because there were Roman merchants and Greek merchants in all of these major Celtic towns. And he used that as a base for exploring the countryside, going and visiting sanctuaries, talking to druids, talking to farmers, talking to warriors, and just collecting all the information he could about the Celts.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that here on our line number one. Caller's in Champaign County. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to divert you from the story as told, as you put together, but it strikes me as kind of odd if this was such a renowned history that it seems like might be some contemporary implications here that any empire seems to have to barbarize. You know, it's easier to dehumanize and justify your colonization of an area. So I wonder if there's any idea that there was some campaign by the Romans, either semi-official or just, you know, we don't want that in our library kind of thing. I'm sure that's probably beyond anybody's real ability to document, considering we're talking about why the document's missing to begin with.
Well, it's really, I mean, it's interesting. We don't know exactly why it disappeared and why some others survived. But, I mean, your point about demonizing the enemy, I think, is perfectly valid. And it's interesting when you look at how the Druids are portrayed before and after the Roman conquest of Gaul. It's really interesting. Before the Romans get there, they're these, you know, horrible, bloodthirsty, they cut off people's heads and perform gruesome sacrifices. But then after Gaul is settled, they get a little bit more romantic about them and you know, start looking at the good points. So, I mean, this idea of demonizing the enemy is a very old technique.
Right. And then another thing that may be not part of your particular purvey in this book is the idea that you don't wipe out a civilization that's existed for millennium in a short period of time, and that there would be a legacy of Celtic lore and that sort of thing. You know, obviously in the fringes of the empire, it's more vibrant. There we have the Irish example, etc. But I don't want to bring up the whole matriarchy-patriarchy thing in pre-Christian Europe, but it seems like there is an argument to be made that, and it has been made by some feminist scholars, I think witches, midwives, and nurses, sort of looks at the way Celtic lore in the form of mainly medicinal kind of things, herbal lore, and that was wiped out, basically, and that they kind of draw a line between the cultural domination of Rome to the burning of the witches, in a way. And I'm just wondering if you've had occasion to speculate on that, even though that's probably not part of this particular intellectual work you have here. And I'll, I think I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to speculate on anything. And actually, it's really interesting. When you look at what does survive after the Romans take over Gaul, a lot of what we have is the lore and evidence from and about women. We have, 100 years after Caesar conquers Gaul, we have actual lead tablets that were written by Celtic women that talk about different sort of medicinal and even magical qualities and spells and things like that. So that after the Romans took over Gaul, once they militarily dominated the place, the Romans didn't really like to interfere too much. As long as people didn't cause any trouble and they paid their taxes, they generally let people live their lives and worship their gods and do whatever they wanted to. And it's interesting, the evidence that does survive about Celtic culture, and it survived at least until the end of the Roman Empire, and then even beyond. We have Christian bishops in, I think, the 700s or so, warning people not to pray to the old Celtic gods, that you shouldn't be doing that. So Celtic culture survived in Gaul for a long time. It survived in Ireland and in parts of Britain, of course, untouched, because the Romans never got to Ireland. So you had this Celtic island that was preserved from any sort of direct Roman influence.
I'm still thinking about, and this is the question the caller asked about how it is, why it is that his work would have been lost, and obviously this is, we really don't have an answer to this, but I'm thinking about the fact that given that in his time that Posidonius was very famous, was very well known, and wrote widely in all of these areas, and I'm assuming that he and his work and his writing was well respected.
Oh, yeah.
How it is, though, that nothing, at least nothing complete, of what he wrote in apparently any of these areas, survived.
Well, actually, it's not as remarkable as it sounds. We have, for example, the Roman poet Catullus, who was very famous, very widely known. We have one surviving manuscript of the works of Catullus. That's all that made it out of classical antiquity. And that is pretty common. The list of things that didn't survive, that were very popular, very wide known, just goes on and on. So, I mean, as odd as it sounds for us, because I think one reason for this is this is pre-Gutenberg, so books weren't actually published, they were handwritten, so there were a lot fewer of them out there floating around. And so over the course of time, whether fire or mice or careless monks or whatever, a lot of these writings were lost. And I don't think Posidonius is unique in this at all.
And I guess, though, that we would assume that people of this time, if you were Greek or Roman or lived in that part of the world and you were well educated, you would have read him?
Yeah, I think so. Most people would have. People like Caesar and Cicero and all of the rest would have read him, and everybody certainly would have heard of him. He was very famous.
Well, let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Well, then there was also the library in Alexandria that was a major repository. Didn't they sort of confiscate copies of things, and when the ships came through Alexandria, copy them and then maybe give them back?
They did, and maybe give them back is right. They certainly copied them, and I think most of the time they did give them back. So you had this wonderful library in Alexandria that had all of these works, and most of which were lost.
And they were destroyed by Christians.
Well, they sort of faded away over time. I think the I'm trying to remember exactly when.
Library, I mean.
Yeah, the library. I don't know that the Christians in Alexandria were certainly active against what they perceived as threats, and they burned down a lot of things. But I think the library in Alexandria, I don't know exactly if it just faded out over time or what exactly happened to it. But most of the works were lost.
Well, was it Hypatia who was the librarian, and she was tortured and executed?
Yes, Hypatia. She was one of the few Greek women philosophers that we know about, and she practically has the life of a Christian martyr, except she wasn't a Christian. She was active there. Where there were a lot of librarians, a lot of very famous people there.
Well, you think about all the statues and so forth that disappeared. were broken, damaged, tossed in rivers, etc., and then didn't reappear until later. And think about how damaged that was. And then think about papers.
Oh, yes.
I would imagine that paper would not survive as readily if it was being treated very callously.
Yes, not at all. I mean, you look at some of the papyri, the things written on papyrus, and we have little fragments of it from Egypt. Really, Egypt's about the only place it did survive because it's so dry there. But even there, all we have are these tiny little bits and pieces. And they've found, just in the last century, they've found a lot of wonderful stuff written on papyrus in Egypt. So they're always finding something new.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. I guess the story that I always thought was true, and maybe it's not quite true, is that the library in Alexandria, this was the biggest library in the ancient world, was destroyed by a fire. But I guess that maybe there's some controversy about exactly what did happen to this large collection, and maybe it was not some sort of one single conflagration that took the library down.
Yeah, and there certainly was a fire, and when Julius Caesar was there, he was in the library, and there was a fire. But it's hard to know exactly what happened.
Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Philip Freeman. He's professor of classics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Also has been visiting scholar at Harvard Divinity School. And he has written a lot about the ancient Celtic world. He's the author of the book St. Patrick of Ireland, and a new one here that we're talking a little bit about. It's entitled The Philosopher and the Druids, A Journey Among the Ancient Celts. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is sort of inspired by, given some structure by, the journeys of the Greek philosopher Posidonius in the ancient Celtic world, something that he wrote about. But as we have mentioned, his book was lost, although we certainly know that people coming after him had read it and were perhaps inspired by it. And so then much of the remaining kind of record that we have about the ancient Celtic world comes from other writers, but he certainly would have been an important one in his time. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL or 9455. So that's the toll-free. And then here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Well, let's talk about the Druids, because it's something, again, I think that in sort of grabs people's imagination. And at the same time, I'm not sure that we really know all that much about who they were, in the sense of what they believed, what sort of rituals they practiced, what the structure, the deep structure of their beliefs were, really. I mean, how much do we know about the Druids?
Well, as I say in the book, you could actually take everything from the Greek and Roman authors that we have about the Druids and put it on one page, probably in very small print, but still, we don't know that much about the Druids. But what we do know is fascinating. We know, my goodness, for example, that they believed in reincarnation. That was one of their central beliefs, that the soul didn't die, it didn't go to some dark, shady Hades like the Greeks and the Romans believed, but that people, after a period of time, were reborn into another body. So that was important to them. We know that the Druids, as I mentioned, were great natural scientists in their own way. They studied the stars, they studied nature, they were judges in private and public disputes. If you had a problem with your neighbor about a stray cow and you couldn't settle it, you went to the local Druid. And they took care, of course, of criminal cases too, murder and things like that. And we know that they were in charge of sacrifices. Sacrifice was just central anywhere in the ancient Mediterranean world, and you didn't do a sacrifice without a Druid present. And most of the time these were very simple sacrifices, like a pigeon or a chicken or maybe a goat. But we know on occasion the Druids did perform human sacrifice.
That is one of those things that again, I think it's sort of controversial, at least in the sense that the Romans said that they did. And then other people have come along and said, well, obviously the Romans were just, they were interested in making the Druids look bad and less than they. And again, to go back to an earlier caller, that might help underpin the notion that if we civilize these people, they're going to be better off. So I gather that there have been questions about whether indeed they did or did not. Does now the archaeological record really, though, tell us, in fact, yes, they did do human sacrifice?
It does, and I think people were right to question these Greek and Roman sources, including Posidonius, who said that the Druids performed human sacrifice. And the Roman authors especially really hyped this up and made it the Druids look like they were performing human sacrifice left and right. But if you look very carefully at what survives of Posidonius, human sacrifice among the Druids was really quite rare. It was not something done frequently. It was something that was usually performed on condemned criminals, people who were murderers, and it was unusual to do this. But archaeology, and this is archaeology just in the last generation, has confirmed, certainly, that there was human sacrifice. They've found some gruesome things up in northern France, these different sanctuaries where they have dozens of skeletons there that were hanging as a sort of display, and they were dressed in their clothing and armor, and they had everything except their heads. And we have other evidence of different times of kinds of sacrifice and the crushing of bones for the marrow. So there really was human sacrifice among the ancient Celts. But one thing the Romans didn't like to mention is that they had human sacrifice in their own history. And so they were a bit ashamed of that.
Hmm. Let's take some other callers here, and we'll talk with someone nearby in Belgium, the community of Belgium, and that's line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, sirs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to introduce into your conversation another aspect about Celt. I produce a toy that I give away, and it's called a Celt or a Celt, and I'm not sure which one it is, and it seems to be fairly old. It's an asymmetric top. In other words, you see tops that just are conical in shape, and you spin them with a string. This is a top that looks somewhat like a canoe, long and thin, rounded, slightly tapered bottom, no top to it. When you spin it, it'll spin up on its point and back down and does some very strange things when you do it. And it's been attributed to be a very old thing. Do you know anything about this being back to their time?
You know, I don't. I've never. That's really interesting. I know that there's this prehistoric tool that archaeologists find all the time. It's kind of like an axe head, but that's called a Celt. But I didn't know about the toy. I don't know.
Well, I've found some of those tools you're talking about. They're prevalent here, but they surely can't be all the way back to Celts. And they're a polished stone that looks somewhat like an axe, usually cylindrical in shape with a sharpened edge. It's very hard to describe it. And they're very, very rare to find, but when you find one, you really get upset. Not exactly an axe head. An axe head has a band around it where it was connected. This is just a long, round tube.
Yeah.
But they're very interesting to find. But they weren't found in any of these tombs or whatever they might be, anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean they weren't. And I would not at all be surprised if this was found. I mean, the Romans had something very similar to what you're talking about. They had top-like toys.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if they borrowed them from the Celts. They borrowed a lot of other things from them.
Yeah, because I've seen it described a few times, and it's always been either a Celt or Celt. I've never heard it said to me before, so...
Well, it depends. Yeah, the pronunciation just of Celts or Celts in general depends if you're... Really, it depends if you're French or German in origin. The Germans say Celt, and the French say Celt. Or if you're a Boston basketball fan.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Others here. Next up, someone in Bloomington, Indiana. This is line 1. Hello.
Hi. You've been talking about the Druids. Would you describe the relationship between the Druids and Halloween? And I'll listen on the air.
Sure, my pleasure. There was a Celtic holiday, which we have evidence of back in Gaul in very ancient times, and in Ireland in medieval times called Samhain. And what it was, and it took place on October 31st, November 1st, and it was a time of the year, it was a harvest festival, basically, but it was a time of the year when our mortal world and then the other world, the world of the gods or the world of the spirits, came closest together. So we have stories from Ireland that talk about on Halloween night, everybody was gathered together inside the community hall, and nobody dared to go outside, because if you did, you might accidentally cross over into that other world, and there are wonderful stories of people who do. So we don't know exactly what the Druids might have done. I'm sure they would have been involved at this Samhain holiday. But we know that this Samhain holiday, which became Halloween, is very much an ancient Celtic festival.
All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. If you'd like to give us a call, let me again introduce our guest, Philip Freeman. He is associate professor and the Qualley Professor of Classics at Luther College. It's in Decorah, Iowa. He has written a lot about ancient Celtic culture and has a newly published book out that's titled The Philosopher and the Druids, A Journey Among the Ancient Celts, published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. Line number one.
Yes, I wanted to ask about bagpipes. I know that most of the modern Celtic areas, the Bretons, the northern Spaniards, and so forth, all have a version of that sort of musical instrument, which we associate, of course, with Scotland and Ireland. But is that a Celtic leftover, or what can we tell you? What can you tell us about that?
You know, I'm not really sure if the ancient Celts had bagpipes, but you know, I think one thing is they wouldn't survive very well, archaeologically over the years. The ancient Celts certainly had all sorts of extremely noisy musical instruments, some of which they used in battle. So I would not at all be surprised if they did use bagpipes. I don't know of any evidence that they did.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak to the role of women in Irish culture during this period of time.
Sure. Oh, I'd be glad to. I have a whole chapter on it in the book, and it's fascinating when you look at it, because the women of the Celts in general, and the women of early medieval Ireland, had more rights, I guess, and more power than you would normally associate with Roman women, and certainly with Greek women, who were pretty much kept in the back of the house their whole life. But we have lots of different stories, and we have different early, very ancient laws from Ireland that probably go back before Christian times that talk about the power of women, the rights of women. For example, in Ireland, some of the earliest laws we have state that a man was always responsible if there was ever a child born of any sort of relationship. The man had very clear responsibilities of supporting this child, and you know, really child support laws and things you just don't find in other early cultures. We even have records in the ancient Celtic stories of women, at least occasionally, leading armies into battle. And we certainly have women like Boudica mm-hmm. from Britain in the first century A.D., who was both a political and a military leader.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And I think we have someone else here to talk with in Kankakee, line number four.
Hello. Good morning, David.
Yes.
Just a quick note about bagpipes that some gentleman just asked about them. And bagpipes are not peculiar to Celtic culture or even European culture. Bagpipes can be found in every indigenous culture all around the world. And they have become associated with Celtic culture because of the Northern European, especially the Scots and the Irish, use of pipes. But they're not. They're all over Europe. In fact, they're all over the world. That's all.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you for the information. See, there's going to be somebody out there who knows the answer to every question. I'm convinced after having hosted the show for a long time, there's someone who knows everything. Well, questions are welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-WILO, toll-free 800-222-WILO. I'm interested in having you talk, again, a little bit more about what we know about the Druids, particularly what they believed. You talked about the fact that, for example, they believed in reincarnation and that they performed various kinds of functions within the society. They helped to settle disputes. They were religious figures. They probably also were the scientists and the philosophers of their culture. What else do we know about the belief system of the Druids?
Well, not a whole lot more than that, honestly. We know we have a description of certain rituals that they used, say with mistletoe, where they use mistletoe as a medicinal plant, and their method of collecting it and things like that. But there's so much about the Druids that we would just love to know that we don't know, at least about the ancient Druids. And we have some evidence from medieval Ireland that helps us. But still, what we don't know about the Druids certainly outnumbers what we do know. But they were the priests, the priestly class, and I don't know. Probably just about everything I've said is everything we know.
Well, let me ask you a different sort of question, because we know that the Romans came along and moved into a lot of these areas and supplanted the traditional cultures. And yet at the same time, we also know that there were pockets that did survive. And I'm sure to the extent that people could, they continued to do what they did before. They might have to be more surreptitious about it, but they continued to do it. And then there also, as you mentioned, there were places like Ireland where the Romans didn't get to, so that the culture would have remained more undisturbed. In what ways would you say that the Celts and Celtish culture beliefs ended up having a larger sort of influence on at least, say, the culture of Western Europe?
Well, it's mostly through Ireland. Not only Ireland, I don't mean to single them out, but also Wales and Scotland and Brittany, where Celtic culture really did survive, that we have the influences that we do that survived into the modern world. And, of course, the tremendous immigration into America from Ireland has brought a lot of that, say, music and stories and Halloween. You know, Halloween comes directly from Irish immigrants into America. So it's especially Ireland that is the transmitter of Celtic culture to the modern world.
Hmm. Were there some ways that particularly you think that that Celtish religious beliefs ended up being absorbed into Christianity?
Well, Halloween is one example, and more especially All Saints' Day. It's no coincidence that All Saints' Day on November 1st is a celebration of the honored dead. That's a direct borrowing into Christianity.
Hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the Celts liked wine, and so perhaps with one of the greatest things that they were interested in their contact with the Greco-Roman world was wine, and it flowed into Gaul through Massalia. What came the other way? What was it that the Greeks, the Romans, those people who fancied themselves civilized would have been interested in that the Celts would have had?
Well, the main thing is slaves. And we know very clearly from the Roman sources that if you were a merchant and you went into Gaul, and if you had a large jar of wine, you could trade that for one Celtic slave. So that was one of the major imports into the Greek and Roman world. But there were other things, of course. The Celts had agricultural production. They had occasionally artwork and weapons and things like that. But it was really slaves that was the major import into the Greek and Roman world. You could go anywhere in the Mediterranean and find a Gaulish slave around.
I knew that I had a question here, and it suddenly came to a halt. Well, maybe we could talk about the end of Celtic culture in a sense, as far as the Romans
coming in, and I'm thinking of Aulus Gallius Divisae and Tripartes, and Caesar having conquered Gaul. What did the Romans do, and in what way did they take this territory, and what did they do with the people that they found?
Well, one thing they did was collect taxes. The Romans were very good at that. But they also used Gaul as a recruiting ground for their army, for the legions. A lot of the Roman army we think of during the time of the empire was made up of Gauls. And so that was a main source for the army. But the Romans went in there, and like I said, they didn't really bother people as long as they didn't cause any trouble. So they would have the temples to all the old Gaulish gods were still there, and they even employed some druids to run them. And they didn't care about the druids as long as they didn't perform human sacrifice. They were fine with them. And so the Romans benefited greatly from not only from Gaul, but from other Celtic areas like northern Italy and Spain, and then, of course, Britain. For 400 years, Britain was a Roman colony.
I guess the thing that I was thinking about before was I'm assuming that basically the Celts were, this was an oral culture. They did not have writing.
They did
have writing.
Yeah, and this is the funny thing. This has mostly been discovered in the last 50 years or so. But there's a number of different Celtic inscriptions all sorts of different things, most of which are honestly kind of boring, but things like property boundaries and things like that. But you do have some wonderful little clay tablets or little what they call spindle whorls that were used in the weaving industry. And the young men and the women of Gaul, and this is a couple of hundred years after Caesar was there, they would write little notes to each other during work on these little clay tablets and send them back and forth. And they mostly, young men and women never really changing throughout history, they mostly involve about wine and trying to set up a date. So we do have some writing.
Well, I think at that, we are going to have to stop. It's a very interesting book, and if people would like to read more about the Celts and the Druids, you can look at the book, The Philosopher and the Druids, A Journey Among the Ancient Cults. It's published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest Philip Freeman, who's professor of classics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Professor Freeman, thank you.
My pleasure.
The broadcast today, made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, providing trophies, plaques, and awards for sports teams, business teams, and many others. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com. We're going to break for news and update on the markets. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where we're seeing wheat contracts higher this morning on both combined commercial and non-commercial buying. Meanwhile, over in the soybean pit, we're seeing lower prices setting back from Friday's rally amid worries about feed demand globally due to the spread of birds.